Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be here after the first segment of today's program. So let's just get started right away with the market report for Thursday, October 27th, 2016. Today we saw Treasury sink. The greenback rose to a seven-month high. And of course, that is because everyone is betting on the Federal Reserve hike in December. And so we had stocks, they fluctuated a little bit. Oil was approaching $50 a barrel once again, but gold still managed to be up most of the day a couple bucks. Currently right now $270 in the New York spot after market price at $1,270. Silver was holding $1,771. It fluctuated quite a bit today. It had a low of $1,747 and a high of $1,780. So 1771 is a number we're going to take, and a good number for silver today. Platinum was up $3 at 968, and palladium took another tumble down 10 bucks at 615. Now that USDX today, that was up 0.25 at 98.87. 98.87, a seven-month high on the USDX. Crude oil was up 0.44 at 49.62. Paper markets today, they were mixed, fluctuated all day long. At the end, the Dow was down 28 points at 18,170. The NASDAQ was down 34 at 52.15. The S&P was down 6 at 21.33. 10-year yield, 1.84%, up 0.05. Euro's still holding at 109. And just a, you know, a mixture of ups and downs. Very little of action in the Asian and European markets. So seems like things might be getting ramped up, of course. Bonds went to their worst month since 2014. Again, perhaps that the global economy is strong enough to withstand shifts away from all of this supposed ultra-easy monetary policy. The UK expansion, UK came out with some good numbers today, and everyone is looking towards tomorrow's report about the US activity, certainly after we've had a sluggish first half of the year. I can't see anything different, but hey, it's an election year. You know, we need to get that Hillary Clinton elected, so we're going to have a great, report tomorrow, but on the economy, but we'll see. On the other hand, we have orders for U.S. business equipment that fell in September by the most in 7 months, indicating corporate investment is having trouble gaining traction. There's a lot of numbers out here. Demand for all durable goods eased 0.1%. Business investment remains slow in the third quarter, as moderating demand and weakness overseas prompted companies to hold back. So again, we have business investment. It's been in a slump for more than a year, and it doesn't seem like there are any numbers to suggest that it's going to break out. This was also confirmed basically with the same comments by senior U.S. economist Omar. How about this? Omar Sharif. But he's the U.S. economist at SocGen out of New York. He thinks it's still going to be a small drag on the third quarter growth. Orders declined for fabricated and primary metals, computers, electronics, and communications equipment. There's been a deluge of debt offerings from governments and companies. Kind of weighed on the markets a little bit today. And again, corporate bond sales have topped $41 billion this week as investors continue to seek some sort of refuge from the more than $10 trillion of negative yielding debt created by policies both in Japan and Europe. Global bonds, they left investors with a 2.5% loss so far this month. That was according to Bloomberg, Barclays Global Aggregate Index. Last week we talked about new car subprime borrowers. They're beginning to get a little bit into trouble, beginning to see losses, loans that are beginning to go bad. Now we're beginning to see the same thing on the used car lot. There have been several large companies that have warned that prices of used vehicles are likely to weaken, potentially leading to higher losses, of course, on the loans on which their cars are the collateral. Plus, you combine that with looser terms for loans and the growth of loans going to subprime borrowers, you know, we're beginning to see, again, warning signs for the long credit boom that has spurred auto sales. Auto loan balances topped $1 trillion for the first time ever this year, and the losses are beginning to tick up. I mean, you could look at it and say, if you have $1 trillion for the first time ever, you will see some losses. That might just be normal. But when we're beginning to see the numbers and the relationship to the percentages of what we've seen before, I think it has a little bit deeper meaning to it than perhaps just, bigger numbers. You're going to have bigger, more losses. I think if we saw better jobs, and we're going to talk about the gig economy here in just a little bit, part-time jobs. We don't have the good-paying jobs we once had to make it think that it's just bigger numbers, you're going to have a little bit greater losses. I think there's something a little bit stronger, something a little more structural that we're seeing as far as these losses that are beginning to tick up. And some of these bigger lendings are beginning to scale back. Losses are going to go higher. This is from Fitch Ratings, a Mr. Hurd. He's the senior director at Fitch Ratings. He says there's no question about that. Ally Financial, used to be GM Financial, the second largest auto loan lender by volume behind Wells Fargo, they said yesterday that it began to see used car values fall in the third quarter. The company wrote off an annualized 1.37% of its outstanding loans in the quarter, up from 1% a year earlier. And it is the highest charge-off rate since at least the end of 2012. So prices of used cars that are up to 8 years old are down 3.6% in 2016. And that was just through September versus the same period a year ago. So again, pressures on the values of these cars are going down. You've had so many new vehicles and those leases, and lease terms are usually up, 3 years, 2-3 years. Now you're beginning to see those on the lots. And this is the first time since 2008 that prices have fallen by any material amount. So again, comparisons back to 2008, because we do have the same problems. Subprime auto loans. In 2015, the new subprime auto loans totaled $109 billion, and that's up 11% from the year before, and roughly 124% from 2010. And these numbers are according to Equifax. So again, these are little warnings, leaves in the breeze, to tell us things are not that good, regardless of what they say, in order to raise rates at the end of the year. I think I mentioned it yesterday, Jeffrey Gundlach, CEO of Double Line Capital, he says bad times lie ahead for bondholders as rising inflation and resurging deficits conspire to drive up interest rates. His predictions, though, are for 2018, 19, and 2020, but he says, look out. He says, but, you know, he thinks we're going to get through 2017 okay. Perhaps we'll just see the cracks widen a little more, but for those 3 years, he says, look out. He also warned that stocks have more downside than upside, where gold has more upside than downside. I don't buy any of these arguments where gold is going to $700. That's crazy. Gold has more upside than downside potential, where stocks, the paper investments, have more downside than upside. How hard can it be to make a decision on where you need to be positioned? Citing data from the Economic Cycle Research Institute, Gundlach said the inflation rate would exceed 3% within 6 months. We all know the inflation rate is higher than 2% now, 1% now, and even 3% in 6 months. But the point is, it is rising. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned this yesterday. He still believes that Donald Trump will win the race for the White House. Trump would and will, when he wins, ramp up the deficit. Even if he doesn't, Hillary is going to do the same thing. Let's see. Apple just briefly reported its first decline in annual sales and profit in 15 years. This was actually, I believe, yesterday. The Silicon Valley company, which had bounced back from near bankruptcy in 97 to become the world's most valuable company today, sales declined by 9%. In the 3 months to September 24th, the third consecutive quarterly fall. The sales hit the company's quarterly profits, which came in at $9 billion, a 19% decline in the same period a year earlier. Well, they're getting a little more competition now. You might see that number rise since Samsung is having problems with their new phones, with the batteries exploding and so forth, or catching fire. You might see this turn around again, but again, you have Amazon coming into the mix with their phones. You have Google coming into the mix with their phones. So, you know, Apple doesn't have the they're not captivating that market as they once had, so you're going to see their sales decline a little bit. You might see that continue for a while. Exxon, you might have some problems there. It's interesting because, you know, their stock is down 17% from its 2014 peak with the crash in oil prices. Their profit has plunged to 17-year lows. Their credit rating has evaporated. But Exxon, they actually report tomorrow, I believe. And Tom Zanzillo said that Exxon's finances suggest that the company may be in the middle of an irreversible decline. But get this. This Tom Zanzillo, he's the director of finance at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, an environmentally focused research group. And as a side note, funded by the Rockefeller family, who recently divorced itself from fossil fuel investments. So he's going to come out and probably say anything bad about Exxon or anyone who has anything to do with fossil fuels. And it makes you wonder if there's an association, because the New York Attorney General launched an investigation into whether Exxon withheld information about the risks of climate change. So it doesn't seem like Exxon is on the same bandwagon as a Rockefeller family, who recently divorced itself from fossil fuel investments, or on the same page. So you wonder if, you know, there's teaching Exxon a lesson. You also have both the SEC and the New York Attorney General. They're also probing into Exxon's accounting methods, focusing on whether the company should have lowered the value of its oil and gas resources given the steep decline in energy prices. So, you know, it looks to me like, since they're not on the same bandwagon, that they're going to make Exxon's life a little bit miserable. But we'll see how that plays out. Of course, we know what's happened to the whole oil industry. So many people have been hurt. Companies, banks, loans being defaulted on because, you know, in the heyday here in the States in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of debt that was created. Now a lot of these companies, these oil companies, and cannot pay back those loans, so they are defaulting. I thought the numbers relating to the gig economy is interesting. I don't know how many of you know what a gig economy is. For those of you who have not heard, it is an environment in which temporary positions are common and organizations contract with independent workers for short-term engagements. The trend toward a gig economy has begun. A study by Intuit predicted that by 2020, 40% of American workers would basically be independent contractors. Most of the estimated 68 million gig workers choose the freelance lifestyle for better work-life balance, but nearly 20 million of them do not, or they do it out of necessity because they can't find better worker pay. A sharper narrative is rising this fall on gig workers who have largely flown under the radar of most economic metrics. It's a booming sector that Hillary Clinton warns raises hard questions about workplace protections and what a good job will look like in the future. And it is interesting. They I guess it kind of makes it a nicer, kinder picture. I had no idea there was 68 million gig workers. And 20 million of them do it out of necessity because they can't find a full job, a 40-hour work week, or better pay. These are the Uber drivers. We have, and as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. officials will be releasing the report on economic growth numbers. But does this sound good to you, that by 2020, 40% of American workers would be independent contractors? It isn't easy to be self-employed. You have to sacrifice. You have to want something. There's a reason why in the past, in the history of the United States of working manufacturing, that there weren't that many self-employed. Sure, we had mom-and-pop shops. There's a lot of them, and people can say that they're the ones that, you know, are the ones that create the jobs. But in today's world, it's difficult to be self-employed. America's growth has been painfully slow. The officials lie about it all the time. But they haven't accounted for gig workers. The Labor Department says it will start counting these workers in job figures by next May. So I figured they're going to count these people as workers, so it distorts again the employment numbers. They're going to start, maybe they'll even add a U8 to the unemployment numbers to make it a little bit rosier and better if they're going to start counting. They're not going to count them as part-time workers anymore. They're not going to count them as people who can't find jobs anymore. They're going to count them as people that are self-employed, independent contractors. So it'll make the job figures much nicer to look at. You have Uber, you have TaskRabbit, you had Etsy, and I'm running out of time. They're growing faster and faster. And for the workers who do it by choice, you know, they might be happier than workers in the traditional 9-to-5 economy. Highly unlikely, because most of them, as this report goes on and talks about, have problems with filing their taxes. They get stiffed by employers. They're uninsured. They don't have health care. The taxes, they don't know how to do their taxes. So I'm not so sure if we have people that are working these jobs that are just uneducated, or are they poorly uneducated, or are they foreigners? And I hear the music. I'm out of time. Alfred and James Corbett will be here in just a few minutes. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on shortwave radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Many, many people have experienced the benefits of drinking all-natural Life Change Tea. The unique blend of 8 herbs helps detoxify your body so you can live a healthier life. Numerous testimonies have been given about the benefits of drinking Life Change Tea. So, are you drinking Life Change Tea? Interested? Log on to GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Many are so impressed with our product, they order a year's supply. And why not? When they do, they receive 2 months free. That's a $70 savings. The body is meant to heal itself. Sometimes a body just needs a little help. Get the tea at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Or call us at 928-308-0408. That's 928-308-0408. This is not an ordinary green tea, and it's not available in stores. This tea helps with digestive problems, acid reflux, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and as talk show host Jerry Doyle says, it'll make you as regular as a baby bird. Enjoy your life. Get Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, a regular on the program, calling in from Japan. And James is, you can find the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T. You know, just Google it. You'll find it. Excellent articles, podcasts, videos on geopolitics, economic issues of economic and political and perhaps philosophical importance. And we'll get to some of those tonight. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
Okay, and now what you're referring to is your children have driven your wife and you into, they've almost got you where they want you, is that right?
Pretty much. We just have a typical cold, but it's a bit overwhelming when you've got two children running around the house, so I'm a bit worn down.
That's why they make Ritalin. It's not for the kids, it's for the teachers and the parents.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, you don't take it, but the kids were given it to the kids so you can get some rest. We're going to talk this evening about blockchain, for example, and what's going on with the idea of digital currencies and how this is affecting the world. That'll be a principal theme. We've got a headline here, Blockchain for President, How It Can Disrupt U.S. Voting Machine. It says, we've heard at the close of the final presidential debate that voting is one of the honors and obligations of living in this great country. And as citizens, we want to feel that our vote is valuable. The question is, do we feel certain in this knowledge that our votes will matter? Is the government doing everything possible to ensure that this is the case? And the article goes on to advocate, at least in part, that blockchain technology be used to verify our votes. can you explain to people a little bit about the blockchain technology and how it might be used? Is it really effective, or could it be effective at protecting our votes?
Yes. Well, people might know blockchain in relation to Bitcoin, and blockchain technology is the innovation, the technological innovation that underlies Bitcoin, but obviously can be used for many other things as well. It's a distributed ledger, which means that it is a ledger that keeps track of certain things like monetary transactions or Bitcoin transactions, but can be used to keep track of other things. It can register, you know, things that you would register with the government, like registering your marriage license or whatever. It could be done in a blockchain. And the idea here is that it's a distributed ledger. There isn't a single central place that contains this information. It is contained in all of the various nodes of the network that is using this technology. So in Bitcoin's example, if you have a Bitcoin wallet, then that wallet, when you sync it with the Bitcoin blockchain, it will take all of the transactions of all of the blockchain, everything that's ever happened on there, and it will sync it with your wallet so that you have all of that information right there with you, and then you use that to transact with other people on that network. So the same thing could be done with, for example, a voting system. It could be done in a distributed way, so that, again, that information about who voted in what way does not exist in any one particular place. It exists everywhere on that network. It is probably the most secure way to do it, in the sense that it can't be erased. I mean, once that information is there, it's recorded and it's viewable by everyone on that network at all times. As long as the network exists, the ledger itself will exist. So that's obviously something that's that speaks in favor of this type of idea. And any revision that is ever made to any of the data in there would itself be recorded in the blockchain. You can never actually delete any sort of information that's on there. It will always be on there, but you can, you know, make amendments to it later that would also be seeable by people on that network. So it is, I mean, it is an important idea, and I think it can be used for such ideas, like, for example, if you wanted to have a different way of registering who voted for what, it might be more secure in that sense, again, that it can't be erased and it can't be censored, it can't be centrally controlled. Everyone sees everything that's happening on that network.
Oh, that's it. But it also, how does it work with, in terms of remaining anonymous in your purchases? And what I mean by that, if I buy something from you, and I subsequently sell it to Todd, the producer, blockchain is going to keep track of every one of the transactions. Wherever you got this item in the first place, I paid you for it, then I sold it to Todd. Every one of the, as I understand it, each link in the chain is registered continuously, and we can find out if Todd has a certain item. We can trace it back, who knows, 1,000 sellers. I'm guessing maybe 500, I don't know. But we can trace it back as far as it goes to its moment of creation. It creates a certain amount of security on one hand, but it also eliminates anonymity on the other hand. Is that true, or can we still be anonymous with a blockchain?
Yes, no. Blockchain Bitcoin is not anonymous. It is pseudonymous. So you will have an address, a wallet address, that is linked to your account. That, yes, you see every transaction that ever happens and ever did happen and ever will happen linked to that address. So any coin that you get into that address or out of that address is going to be tracked from the moment of its creation all the way through every single hand it's ever changed through. The idea here is that the address, you know, 1K7B73824, you know, this ridiculous address that's assigned to you, is itself unique and traceable. Again, you can see everything that happens with it, but it isn't in any fundamental sense linked with you as a person that's identifiable, unless dot dot dot. So if you are careful in the way that you set up your account and what you do with it, you can maintain pseudonymity. You will be known as that address, but no one necessarily knows that that address is your address. So that's the short answer. There's a lot more to it, but obviously, again, when you have the NSA or whatever kind of government alphabet soup agency that is literally the trunk of the internet and literally listening in the back door of all the telecoms agencies, it is... highly questionable the extent to which anyone can truly maintain even pseudonymity.
Yeah.
It's probably they have ways of unmasking, and that's the Silk Road and all of those kinds of things. Ultimately, when they want to bust them, they will eventually find a way to bust them, and it usually involves the user being a bit careless here or there, but still, it can be done.
How secure Bitcoin is becoming? At least a minor contender for a global currency. How secure is Bitcoin? Because we hear stories that millions of Bitcoin units are occasionally pirated, hacked, stolen. And I'm curious how that, not just how that can happen, but if I'm going to steal Bitcoin units that are protected by blockchain, where do I spend them if they carry an innate tracking mechanism that says, you essentially said, I stole it from the bank down the street. How does this work? People are stealing bitcoins, if I understand correctly. How do they spend them if the blockchain is there to tell us where they were, where they came from?
Well, so this is where it starts to get technically complex. But the idea here is that it's not that people are reaching into your account and taking the coins out of the account. If they hack into your account, it means that somehow they've gotten the key to your account, as it were, the keys that help them operate that account, so they can spend money into or out of that account. Now, generally speaking, there's no way, once someone has done that, they've hacked your keys and they have the keys to the wallet, there's no way for you to go to some sort of, there is no central authority for you to go to say, hey, no, that's me, but someone has got my key and is using my account. There's no way to do that. Again, there's no central body that oversees Bitcoin. Now, depending what wallet you have and what way you have it set up, through blockchain.info or whatever, service you use, there might be ways to help prevent that or to work around that or to maybe... but there's no way to undo a transaction once it's been done. So once something's been spent out of your account or sent to your account, there's no way to undo or
including once it's been stolen out of your account.
Yes, essentially. But again, it's the method of stealing, and then who do you appeal to? So it isn't. It isn't secure in the sense that, for example, with Visa or whatever, if somebody steals your Visa card and goes on a spending spree, generally speaking, if you are able to indicate to Visa and prove that your card was stolen, these were fraudulent transactions, they can be reversed eventually, because that is a centralized system with a central authority that governs all the transactions going through it. Bitcoin is not like that. There is no central authority. So if you lose your keys, or if someone gets a handle on your keys, essentially you're out of luck. Now, there are different ways to think about this. In fact, there was an idea called Ethereum, and I won't get into all the details about this, but it was this sort of other, like a Bitcoin type of idea, and was working on blockchain technology that, from the very moment that it launched, was immediately hacked, and a bunch of the Ethereum coin, as it were, was stolen, essentially, by the hacker. And so, this being a slightly different organization, it was set up to be a type of thing where you have essentially shares in voting on what Ethereum would do. And so they voted to undo those transactions. And so that what you had was a split in the ledger. One of the ledgers is the one where the hackers have the stolen coin. The other is the other version where they undid those transactions. So there are people now interacting on both of those different ledgers. And so you have Ethereum Classic, and then you have the new Ethereum. So those are the types of things that this gets into, and it can be very strange and weird. But essentially, Bitcoin, I think at this point, is committed. They're never going to undo transactions like that and force a hard fork in the Bitcoin blockchain. So yes, it's different in that sense. If someone steals your keys, if they hack into your account in that way, there's essentially nothing you can do about it once the coins have been spent out of your account.
It sounds like this could be a perfect environment for thieves. They'd have to be
amongst
intelligent
others,
thieves,
yeah.
And technologically knowledgeable and the rest of that. But there's no enforcement. You steal this, and there's no one to make you give it back. Plus, you may be able to still use it. And some people might even approve of the theft. If you've got this fork where you have now essentially doubled at least part of the Bitcoin volume of money. Is that necessarily a bad thing or a good thing? Or a tolerable thing?
Well, that's not exactly the way the fork works. The fork is will commit you and your wallet and your address to commit to one of the or other of the ledgers. So you have to choose, ultimately, which one you're going to be interacting with. And then once you've made that decision, you know, there's no going back. So you you know, it forks in that way. It doesn't double the money supply, per se. But it still, yeah, would be very problematic. The Bitcoin ledger has never done that type of fork. They are looking at different options that they want to tinker with and things, which will cause a fork. And it gets very, very technical and very complicated. I think the takeaway for most of the listeners here would be it is a very technically complex environment. And that is obviously what scares a lot of people away from it, which is why I would never suggest people put their life savings in Bitcoin, especially if you're not, you know, very technically savvy and know about how to do cold storage and paper wallets and that type of thing. But I think it is, and again, I mean, people might look at it and say, well, every transaction can be traced to your address and all of this kind of thing, and oh, it's so horrible. Well, you know, I mean, as opposed to spending on Visa, in which, of course, every transaction you do is not just traced to your account, it's traced to your name and address and phone number and email address and whatever else information they have. So, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a perfect system, but it's certainly a different system. And, of course, it gets around all of the intervening government agencies that want to put their snoot into every transaction that goes on in the world. It certainly has its uses. I wouldn't say it's going to be a currency that's going to replace the dollar or anything like that at any conceivable point. But I think as one monetary arrow in the quiver, as it were, I think it certainly serves a certain use for transacting online and internationally.
If we had government control of something like Bitcoin, and government were able, and government was there to enforce the idea of private property, and in other words, you can't steal this. If you stole it, government would track you down one way or another and make you pay for that theft. Would that be an improvement, or would that eliminate whatever pseudonymity remains? Just eliminate it, and government would be watching your every move. Good idea, bad idea?
Right. I mean, this is essentially the question, and what people want to use it for, and the way they want it to be. I mean, there are people who advocate that want Bitcoin to comply with all the regulators and become a sort of official stamp of approval type of currency that can actually be used in that sense. And so there are a number of different things that they want to have done that will make it more friendly for the would-be regulators of the world. And then you have, on the other side, the people who say, no, the entire point of Bitcoin is to avoid all of that, and yes, it's going to be the Wild West, but that's what we want. Yeah. We want a Wild West system. So there is that tension there, and, I mean, it's still only 6-7 years old at this point, so it's still a pretty new technology, and there's still, I think, a fight for the soul of what Bitcoin is going to be.
We got an article here from Cointelegraph, and it says top British banks stock up on Bitcoin for cyber ransoms. Several of London's largest banks are stocking up on Bitcoin in order to pay off cyber criminals who threaten to bring down their critical IT systems, say IT experts. The banks are now coming to terms with the view that it's cheaper to pay off the criminals than risk ferocious cyber attacks on a high scale. And part of the reason for this is that even the police do not have resources to deal with the significant growth of the number of cyber attacks. And therefore, if somebody robs your bank, the police, it may take them months or years to straighten this mess out, if ever. And the banks just find it more economical to simply pay the thieves to turn their computers back on, these cyber attacks, ransomware and so on. Does this inspire anyone's confidence about dealing with Bitcoin and the digital technology?
Oh, of course not. And that's the exact point of stories like this. I pointed this out last year when Radiolab did a show about this type of thing, not on banks, but on regular people getting their computers hacked into and their entire computer frozen. And they get a message from hackers saying, we'll unfreeze your computer if you pay us, you know, X number of Bitcoin in, in the next 30 days, and if you don't, yeah, we're going to erase everything. That mm-hmm. is becoming more common as a story, as an idea, as a meme, and this is generally how the general public will be introduced to Bitcoin for a lot of people. That's the first they'll ever have heard of it, let alone used it. And obviously, I think that's a type of a psychological operation in and of itself to get people to care about Bitcoin and associate it with evil, you know, criminals, basically, rather than everything else that it can do.
We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back with James Corbett on financial survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm Alfred Attisk.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Attisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We've been talking about blockchain, a new technology, a revolutionary technology. Wondering where it's going to go, and will it inspire confidence, or will it be discredited? And one of my last questions on this subject is, if it turns out that blockchain is a little too flaky, it's not ready for prime time, and the Bitcoin, the digital currency Bitcoin, and blockchain doesn't protect it adequately, this will tend, if we see more hackers able to steal Bitcoins, for example. If that's what we see, it will discredit the Bitcoin technology. Will this spread to Visa and MasterCard and American Express, where other our usual credit cards and debit cards and whatever, will they also be discredited by this?
Well, of course not, because they're trusted institutions. The funny thing is that banks and even credit card processors and others can, and to some extent at least, are starting to look into the idea of adopting blockchain technologies to facilitate their transactions, in the sense that they would use that internally to send the information without going through the traditional, you know, banking route and banking system and infrastructure they have set up. They can use a blockchain technology to communicate with each other around the world to process these payments and what have you, but they would ultimately control that ledger it wouldn't be Bitcoin where it's distributed and everybody has access to it and everybody interacts on that network. It would be, you know, Visa's proprietary network or, you know, whatever, Bank of America or whatever. And so they would be taking advantage of the technology itself, but they would be the ones stewarding over it and being, you know, the only users on that network. So I think this technology, the technology itself is here and it's going to stay. The question of whether they can, you know, adequately demonize Bitcoin and other uses of that technology in a way that will get the public to stop ultimately using it is, I think, still the point in question. And to a certain extent, I think there is at least a section of the user base of Bitcoin who would say, great, I don't care. I don't want this to be, you know, every single person scrambling to get Bitcoin. I want to use it for my own, you know, purposes with people that I can interact with who also use Bitcoin on the other side of the world. I don't care who sees this as a good idea or a bad idea or what they, you know, whether it's demonized in the public, as long as I can use it. And then there are the other people who want to use Bitcoin as a regular type of currency who obviously want this to spread. So again, I think there's still a tension there between the two sides.
I've got an article from Prophecy News Watch entitled U.S. Army Will Have More Robots Than Human Soldiers by 2025. 9 years from now. In the next 9 years, the U.S. Army will have more combat robots than humans, according to John Bassett, a former U.K. United Kingdom intelligence officer. Bassett, who worked for 20 years in the England's government communication headquarters, told attendees at a counterterrorism meeting in London that the U.S. is attempting to stay ahead of the curve by employing thousands of robot soldiers over the next few years. They predict that these soldiers will operate at lower costs and lead to higher rate of success in U.S. military operations. We could talk about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, but I suppose it's an inevitable idea. Is it likely to work?
Well, I mean, hey, we can hope that at some point it'll just be robots fighting robots and we'll never have to have another human die in battle, right?
Well, that's a good theory.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the theory behind the Terminator, ultimately. They created these robots and gave them and made them increasingly autonomous. They could think for themselves, and pretty soon one of the robots looked at one of us and said, hey, why don't we get rid of him instead of killing all the other robots?
Yes. And in fact, if you go into the extended universe of the Matrix movies, you'll find that that was the original idea there as well. The robots eventually rise up and, you know, try to overthrow the
human. Yeah, that's right.
It's a common science fiction trope, and it's not just science fiction. There is a real concern there, and that's why, for example, Asimov came up with his laws of robotics and, you know, the I will not cause harm to human beings and whatever else is hard-coded into every robot, because without that, you know, who knows what they might do. It is a common theme, and in fact, it is being taken up more and more by, you know, not just science fiction writers, but serious thinkers. There have been a number of initiatives signed off on by people like, I believe Elon Musk was associated with it, and others have been talking about this, the idea of autonomous killing machines, ultimately, and how they're going to interact, you know, with real human beings, how they're going to act on the battlefield, how we can contain that and control that and be assured of our control over it. It is a genuine concern. And so, but as you say, I think you're exactly right. I don't think there is a putting a bottle back on, a cap back on that bottle. I'm not sure you can put the toothpaste back in the tube. It is coming. If it's a weapon that can be used on the battlefield to the advantage of one or the other of these, you know, the sides in a conflict, who's going to say to the other side, no, you shouldn't develop your own autonomous robot killing units, because, you know, that will start the, unwinnable escalation of the technology. So no one's ever going to be convinced to stop developing this technology. The only thing that will happen, like everything else that ever happens in terms of technological developments when it comes to killing people more effectively, is an arms race, which will lead to more and more of this technology. It's not a happy picture, and I wish I had something happy to say about this, but I really don't see any way to put the brakes on this once this starts getting out.
Did you ever hear of a man named Robert Ardrey? I believe he was the author of African Genesis, a book that was published back in the 1960s. You ever hear that name?
It doesn't ring a bell, no.
One of his one of his central arguments is that we call man the tool-making animal. All right? And he says that's a mistake. Man is not the tool-making animal. He is the weapon-making animal. And he says it was his argument that weapons were the central focus of human civilization. All right? We're not all worried about making a ship that'll go to the Mars or whatever. We're interested in how to kill the other people. And it was a fundamental theme, and weapons were the real focus and the driving force behind civilization. In the course of his book, at one point, he pointed out that the Pope, back in maybe the 1400s, maybe the 1200s, I don't know when, I don't remember clearly, but the Pope declared that the crossbow could not be used on Christians. It could only be used on Muslims and non-Christians because it was such a devastating weapon. And you can see where we've gone from there. I mean, you can't use the crossbow on Christians. It's so devastating. There's nothing that seems able to stop us from developing bigger and better weapons. And we get in now we've already talked about two movies. Dr. Strangelove comes to mind as the next one. Build a better weapon and the world will beat a path to your doorstep, apparently. You've got article.
Well, I was just going to say, it's funny you mentioned Dr. Strangelove, because what that brings to my mind is 2001, where the ape men at the beginning, the first technology that comes after the monolith, they encounter the monolith is a weapon, essentially. Mm-hmm. They learn how to smash, you know, people's heads in with bones, and this is the start of human civilization, according to that movie. Right?
Yeah. You've got an article that you wrote for the International Forecaster entitled "How the Government Uses the Banks to Choke Off Legal Businesses." And you have the idea behind the article is that tell the story of an individual. I don't see the name, but you tell the story of an individual who had a little business, 9 branches of his business, and all of a sudden his bank shut down his access to the bank accounts he'd been using for years, and as a consequence, his business was hugely impaired. He couldn't get around this, and this was apparently being done, or at least potentially being done, for political reasons. You want to amplify on this and tell us what the banks are doing or can do?
Yes. You're referring to the story of Brian Lynn, who was a former Marine Corps officer. He mm-hmm. became the CEO of a payday lending company that had branches, 26 branches, in Florida, Georgia, Alabama. He'd been operating them for over 2 decades, and then in 2014, he gets this letter from SunTrust and Bank of America, where he had accounts for his company, both saying, we review these accounts on a regular basis, and your account no longer meets our specifications, so it will be closed, essentially. And so he freaked out and started, trying to find out what is this about. He called Bank of America and SunTrust and trying to get to the bottom of it, and ultimately they went up. They didn't know themselves, the branch that he was dealing with, so they had to go up the corporate ladder, and they went to their superiors, and they were told, no explanation, but the decision is final. Your accounts are closed. And so he had 30 days, I think, to get his money out into somewhere else. And he ended up going, I think, to 21 other banks, something like that, in order to find one that would finally take him on. And he just got his money out, I think, just in time, which is, it's a crazy story. And ultimately, this is not just one isolated incident. This has been happening hundreds and hundreds of times to all sorts of businesses across the U.S. over the past few years under a operation that operated by the Department of Justice, ultimately, that was not supposed to be known to the public. It got out in 2013. It was reported on at that time by the Wall Street Journal. But this was an operation called Operation Choke Point. What a happy little name. That the DOJ set up. Basically, it was a plan to use the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which I'm sure your listeners know is what guarantees a certain amount of money in your bank account. They're the ones that will backstop that. But FDIC-compliant banks obviously have to comply with whatever conditions the FDIC puts on them. And so the DOJ thought, hey, we have all of these shady businesses that we don't like, these Ponzi schemes and, get-rich-quick scams and, gun sales and things like that. We don't really like those industries, so we're going to start putting pressure on banks through the FDIC to not hold accounts for these types of businesses. And this actually, so Congress found out about this. They started hearings into it. They found out this goes back to at least 2011 when the FDIC put out this chart of basically new compliance requirements that they were putting out. And they had a bunch of different high-risk, quote-unquote high-risk industries that they decided they don't want banks to cover anymore, not just the pyramid schemes and online gambling and debt consolidation scams and other really shady businesses, but completely lawful, completely regulated businesses, coin dealers, firearms merchants, tobacconists, I mean, completely legal businesses, but the FDIC was leaning on banks to close their accounts. And obviously it's worked because there are, as I say, hundreds of accounts of different business owners getting their bank accounts closed suddenly and with no warning. This is just unthinkable, just an unthinkable abuse of executive power when you think about it, because it's not even directly traceable to the Department of Justice unless you uncover the documents, as Congress ultimately did, showing the plan to use this. It's all done through the FDIC putting pressure on banks, so it's, in a sense, voluntary. A bank doesn't have to follow this. It's just if you want to be FDIC compliant, you're going to have to show that you're complying with this program. So it is a really Orwellian system by which the government can essentially shut down legal businesses without having to be the ones to come in and shut them down. It's all done through the banking system, so it's a level of remove. And so what I'm trying to write about in this article is not just, although obviously that is creepy enough, but think about how much worse this will get if we move to a cashless society where literally all you have is an account, a chip, whatever, that people will scan to take credits out of your account. Well, when the government has the power ultimately to turn on or off that chip, it literally will be the mark of the beast system. You want someone out of the system, you just turn off their chip and they can't interact with other people, which is, I mean, horrific when you think about it. And the only good point about this is, since we know this is coming, we know this is ultimately where this heads, well, that gives us plenty of time and opportunity to get out of the banking system that they want us involved in and to start exploring those other ideas, like Bitcoin,
for example,
but many other ideas as well, local community exchanges and things of that. And if we don't start building those things up now when we have the chance, then it will be too late when you're ultimately faced with that, oh, we have deactivated your chip, sir, and you can't transact. So, you know, please head to your nearest FEMA emergency camp for your labor assignment or, you know, whatever the equivalent will be.
We live certainly in interesting times. Will people start to move back to cash? They say they want a cashless society. Will people move back to things like gold and silver and start transacting in coins? Do you think that's a probable, or will it be just penalized instantly, catch you with a coin and you do,
yeah,
I don't know, 6 months for a penny and a year for,
yeah,
you know, a quarter, a dime, and silver or gold, that'll get you sent away for life?
Well, yeah, there's a few questions here. One of them is, will they? The other is, should they? Obviously, I think people should start transacting more in ways like that that are not part of this banking system. Will they? I don't know about you, but I don't know very many people who see a need to get out of the banking system as it exists because they don't really think about or care about these types of ideas. So yeah, there's a kind of a disconnect there. But even if people start doing this, even on a limited scale, there is that other question of, well, will the government allow it, quote unquote? And of course, I mean, it's not up to the government to allow what we do amongst each other, but somehow or other they'll come in and try to
inhibit it. That's for sure.
Exactly. I mean,
we're out of time, James.
No, right. Okay.
I want to thank you very much for being on the program. It's James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams,